about some joint work with Laurent Friedel that's still in progress. Good. So the quantity I want to talk about is entanglement entropy. So suppose that you have a quantum state. Could be, for example, the state of a quantum scalar field. And there's some, say there's a black hole around, and you want to have a description of this state that reflects your ignorance of what's inside the black hole. It need not be a black hole. You could just decide you don't wish to make measurements in some region of space, for example. So call the region that in which you do wish to make measurements sigma, and call the rest sigma bar. We can arrange the Hilbert space of our theory as a product between degrees of freedom that we care about and those we don't care about. We can perform this operation of partial trace that gets rid of those things we don't care about. And what we're left with is this mixed state rho. In the process of throwing away this information, we gain some entropy. And this entropy is called the entanglement entropy. It's the von Neumann entropy of this state, rho sub sigma. So this quantity has quite a history. It was introduced, the first place I'm aware of was by Raphael just over 30 years ago. And the idea was that this could be used to understand the appearance of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, this entropy associated with black hole horizons. But since then, it's sort of exploded in its application. For example, in condensed matter theory, people use this now as a probe of topological phases of matter. And to name another, in string theory, it's used frequently in the ADS-CFT correspondence. So it has a very sort of powerful probe of the holographic geometry. So, but there's an issue with this quantity, which is that in many of these examples we're interested in, we have some local gauge symmetry. So for example, in the topological phases I mentioned, these are have emergent low energy excitations with an emergent gauge symmetry. In the ADS-CFT context, the theory you're talking about is an SUN gauge theory at large n, so it has an awful lot of gauge symmetry. And in the gravitational context, which is what I'll be most interested in, there's diffeomorphism symmetry. Okay. And when you have such a symmetry, there is no straightforward factorization of the Hilbert space in terms of degrees of freedom in some region sigma and in its complementary region sigma bar. So a priori, you don't have this factorization. It's not clear how one would define entanglement entropy. So the main question that I want to address, what could replace this factorization in a gauge theory? You know, for example, what do we mean by these, Hilbert spaces associated to some region? And from that, can one construct a sensible notion of entanglement entropy? So why is it that we don't have a factorization of the Hilbert space like this in a gauge theory? Well, let's take the example of Yang-Mills theory. The states that we construct have to be gauge invariant states. So you can't just take any old functional of the vector potential A. That wouldn't be a gauge invariant thing to do. But on a closed manifold, complete set of gauge invariant observables. These are given by Wilson loops. So you take the trace of the connection, or the path ordered exponential of the connection. You take the trace of that in some representation, and that defines your Wilson loop. So you can express your Hilbert space in terms of these, and you get the physical gauge invariant Hilbert space. Now, suppose you have this region sigma and you want to associate a Hilbert space to that. Well, if you want to include states like these sort of Wilson loop states and you want to sort of cut them off, say, along this dotted line, it's clear that you need to have something like a Wilson loop that ends on the boundary. So in order to define this, we allow Wilson lines now, they're not closed loops, we allow them to end on the boundary. So this introduces some new degrees of freedom. Ordinarily, Wilson lines are allowed to end only on charges. So these new degrees of freedom live only at the boundary, and they act very much like charges in the sense that they transform non-trivially under the gauge group of the boundary. And now suppose we define a Hilbert space in this way, then what we have is we have a Hilbert space associated to each region, which consists of these loops that are allowed to end. And now we can construct a tensor product of those two spaces, but this full space actually contains more than just our physical states. In particular, it'll contain things like this, where the these sort of charges don't match up on the boundary. The physical states of our original theory sits inside that. It consists of the states that are like this, where the Wilson loop endpoints actually match. So we don't have a factorization, but we have something that's close to it. That's basically because we're imposing gauge invariance at the boundary. Yes, Lee?
You don't allow the Wilson lines to run in the boundary?
That's a good question. I think, So this construction has been made precise on the lattice, and the way it was done was to cut the lattice so that you don't have any lines running directly along the boundary. It's a good question. I think that you would want to allow them to run along the boundary, but I'm not totally sure about that. Anyway, as I alluded to, this construction can be made precise on the lattice, with the caveat that you don't cut a link sort of lengthwise. And this is sufficient in order to define an entanglement entropy. You can take your state, which lives here, you can embed it over here, which has which admits a factorization, and you can calculate entanglement entropy there. And that entropy seems to have all the properties that one would expect of an entanglement entropy. Right. But now, what if we're in a case where we don't have the analog of Wilson loops, where we don't have this complete set of gauge invariant observables? Indeed, maybe we don't even have a handle on exactly what's the Hilbert space of quantum gravity. Okay, so the idea is to consider a very closely related classical problem, and to try to we can ask, what do we mean by a classical phase space associated with a region of space? And then we can attempt to quantize that to construct something like a Hilbert space associated to the region sigma. Okay. And this should work, in gravity we have a good handle on what is the classical phase space. So we're going to follow this covariant canonical formalism. And the way that works is as follows. So you start with a Lagrangian density L. You vary it in the usual way, as if you were deriving the equations of motion. So you integrate it. You vary and you integrate by parts. So you get the equations of motion as usual. And then you define your phase space to be the space of solutions to the equations of motion. You also get a total derivative left over. If you're just deriving the equations of motion, you throw it away. But if you're trying to figure out the symplectic structure, you keep it, because indeed this gives you your symplectic potential when you integrate it over this surface sigma. So this theta is the symplectic potential. It tells you the Poisson brackets on your manifold. This is the analog in mechanics. It would be like pi dqi summed over I. So it tells you that p and q are canonically conjugate. So for a surface sigma without boundary, this would define a phase space. Your phase space would consist of gamma with this symplectic potential theta. Right. So here's how it works, for example, in Yang-Mills. I'll just show that it gives you the same. I'll show how to get back this idea of this space of Wilson loops that end on the boundary. So for Yang-Mills, you follow that procedure. The theta you find looks like E dot delta A. Okay. So fine, but this isn't gauge invariant. So is this a problem? Well, consider what happens under a gauge transformation. What you find is theta, when you apply a gauge transformation, changes but only by a total derivative. So if sigma is a closed is a surface without boundary, then it is indeed genuinely gauge invariant, and you can view it as a you can view it not only as a symplectic potential on the space of A's, but on the space of gauge orbits, which is what you need in order to have a gauge invariant symplectic structure. But if you have a boundary, that's not the case. It changes by this total derivative integrates to a surface term. In order to make this the symplectic potential gauge invariant, you have to add a boundary term that compensates this change here. Okay, and it lives on S, which is what I'll call the boundary of sigma. And now we have, and notice that this boundary term that you have to add depends explicitly on this G living on the boundary, which is your choice of gauge, and also on delta G. So your new phase space consists of variables A, a connection on the interior, a choice of gauge on the boundary, and your symplectic potential now has two terms, one which has delta A and one which has delta G. And working this out, you find non-trivial Poisson brackets for observables on the edge. In particular, the electric field perpendicular to S obeys these Poisson brackets, these commutation relations, thank you, which are those obeyed by non-abelian gauge charges. So these are effectively like charges that live on the surface. They're just like the endpoints of these Wilson loops. Okay. So can we repeat this story for gravity? In particular, what are the extra boundary degrees of freedom, the analogs of the Gs? What's the symplectic structure theta? What are the generators, the analog of these E perps? And what's the algebra that they generate? So first of all, there's a new issue that's not present in Yang-Mills theory. The gauge transformations are diffeomorphisms. These are motions in space, and some of them are going to move our entangling surface S, our boundary. Okay. So for now, we're going to cut those out and focus only on those diffeomorphisms that preserve S, which means for infinitesimal V, we split. So if you have an infinitesimal diffeomorphism, you can split it into a tangential part that's going to preserve the surface, a normal part that isn't going to preserve it, and so you set the normal part to zero at the surface. So so as I said, you keep infinitesimal diffeomorphisms that move along the surface. You're allowed, of course, to have a normal component. The normal component vanishes at the surface, but it can have a non-vanishing first derivative. And so in particular, you can deform the normal plane to S. And so how much of this, and some amount of this diffeomorphism group will become physical. And I'll show you just how much of it. So like I said, there are new boundary degrees of freedom, the analogs of G. So the you have all the original phase space stuff, the metric and its conjugate variable, which is the extrinsic related to the extrinsic curvature of sigma. But now, just like you keep the gauge transformation of the boundary, you keep a diffeomorphism in a neighborhood of the boundary. Following the same procedure, you get a natural symplectic structure, which again depends not only on the metric, but also on the choice of diffeomorphism and its variation, delta x. And one can construct a Hamiltonian that generates diffeomorphisms along a vector field V, and it takes this form as an integral over the boundary surface. And one can check, indeed, these do generate diffeomorphisms, and they satisfy the Poisson brackets that you would expect from diffeomorphism generators. And one can write this sort of more explicitly in terms of the local geometry in particular. For surface preserving diffeomorphisms, it takes this form. You have you break your diffeomorphism into a tangential part and this this normal part. The thing that sits in front of the normal plane deformation is the normal metric divided by the square root of its determinant, which makes it a unit determinant metric, or minus one determinant metric. You densitize it with the density on x. Thank you, on s, and the quantity that sits in front of the generator of tangential diffeomorphisms is the twist of the surface. So you take two. The twist is defined as you take two normals, unit normals, time-like one and a space-like one, to the surface S, and their commutator projected in the tangent direction is the twist.
What is X of S?
Ah, good. So S is the surface. X of S is the surface under diffeomorphisms. I've defined that. So what this means is you pull back by the diffeomorphism x and then integrate. So maybe a better notation for this would have been integral over s of x star of the quantity there. It's important because otherwise this. It's sort of the analog of before we had g inverse delta g. It's saying basically you undo the gauge transformation. That's sort of what this is. And it's important because without it, this expression wouldn't depend on x. And so you wouldn't, when you, or rather this, the it was also in the symplectic potential. It's the reason that you get a delta x term in the symplectic potential, which is what leads to non-trivial commutators between the geometric observables. Well, the generators on the inside vanish, so it's all because it's all on shell.
So it's generating
diffeomorphisms everywhere. Yeah, except the ones on the inside are pure gauge. The ones that aren't pure gauge, this is just sort of the residue that lives on the boundary. Pardon? That's right. Yes. Good. Since we're running long time, you can read off the commutators between these. The H's, the normal plane diffeomorphisms, generate an SL2R algebra, which is this one, or local SL2R transformations at each point. The twists generate diffeomorphisms, so this is the algebra of diff of S. And then the algebra between them just says that the A's generate diffeomorphisms of the generator's H. So together they form this algebra, which is the diffeomorphisms of S acting on local SL2R transformations. Okay. And interestingly, the area form on the horizon is square root of determinant of Q, which is the square root of the determinant of H, because H is unimodular up to this factor of square root of determinant of Q, which is related to the Casimir of SL2R. Good. So just to conclude, in a gauge theory, we don't have a nice factorization of the Hilbert space that you would have, say, in a scalar or spinner theory. There are new degrees of freedom on the boundary, which we call edge modes, and gravity follows the same pattern as, say, Yang-Mills theory. The boundary degrees of freedom generate gauge transformations of the boundary, and in gravity, these are a certain subgroup of the diffeomorphisms. So for future work, we'd like to consider diffeomorphisms that move the surface, as well as the surface-preserving ones, and also to consider quantization, which is to say, to find representations of this algebra. So thank you.